For example, in Season 4's Fun Run episode, there's a conference room scene where Michael is brainstorming with the group about Dunder Mifflin being cursed. He says maybe they should make a sacrifice to remove the curse and starts listing mythical animals. Steve improvised quite a bit in this moment, and I was mesmerized. Angela Martin was supposed to be sad because Sprinkles died, but I just sat there with the silly grin on my face watching Steve do his magic. Seriously, though, you try remembering to act while Steve Carell looks at you and says, maybe there's some sort of animal that we could make a sacrifice to, like a giant buffalo or some sort of monster, like something with the body of a walrus with the head of a sea lion, or something with the body of an egret with the head of a meerkat, or just the head of a monkey with the antlers of a reindeer with, the body of a porcupine.
Steve is the most skilled improviser I've ever had the pleasure to work with, most notably because of his patience. Steve is not afraid to let a moment or an idea breathe. He never rushes, and he never breaks. He would stay in character under almost any circumstance. I know a lot of comedic actors who are great at coming up with clever, improvised lines, and this was certainly true of Steve. But what sets Steve apart is his ability to communicate so much through his improvised behavior and reactions. A small moment that comes to mind is in the Season 3 episode Branch Closing, when Jan must deliver the news that corporate has decided to shut down the Scranton branch. During the shoot, a set of wind-up teeth began to spontaneously chatter on Steve's desk. This was not a scripted moment, just a strange accident. But Steve didn't laugh. And he didn't stop the scene. He grabbed the teeth and reacted as Michael Scott would react in the moment, with a mixture of delight and frustration, and then continued with his scripted dialogue. It was brilliant.
Steve's superpower is knowing when you're about to break and going for it until you do. I learned that I couldn't make eye contact with him when this was happening or he would destroy me. So I started staring at his neck. After 7 years, I learned every inch of it. I could probably draw it for you. Sorry if that's creepy, Steve, but if I looked you in the eye, I was a goner. Sometimes I could lean into my character's disdain for Michael to avoid eye contact. In the episode Women's Appreciation, I had to sit next to Steve in a Victoria's Secret store while he/Michael asked me/Angela Martin what type of undies I'd want. It took all my willpower not to laugh and keep my stern exterior until he improvised this line. Santa's come early. Santa would like to buy you a pair of panties, little girl. And, well, I completely lost it.
I loved any scene where I got Steve all to myself. Some of my favorites include Season 3's Diwali, outside on the steps when Michael tries to kiss Pam, Business School, also Season 3, where Michael is the only person to come to Pam's art show. Season 5's Lecture Circuit, where Pam joins Michael as he travels to the other branches to share his best business practices. The entire Michael Scott Paper Company arc in Season 5. And most of all, Goodbye Michael in Season 7. In our final scene together in Goodbye Michael, Pam runs after Michael in the airport after she missed him in the office that day, just before he boards the plane to be with Holly. When we shot that scene, our director Paul Feig told me he would be capturing the scene without any audio and needed the emotions to play out on our faces. He suggested I run up to Steve and tell him goodbye, not from Pam to Michael, but goodbye from Jenna to Steve. The first take we did went over 5 minutes, as I shared with Steve from my heart what working with him for those 7 years had meant to me. On both a personal and professional level, Steve had made an impact on my life. For instance, when my dad retired, Steve stayed late at work one day and made a video for him as Michael Scott. We used that video to kick off the retirement party for my father. I still have the video, and Steve agreed to let me play it for you.
Hello, Jim. Congratulations on your retirement. I understand that you were the Michael Scott of your office, and that is a dubious distinction. Going forward, I'd like you to remember that you are now entering exciting and uncharted territory. That's what she said. Congratulations.
So, as you can see, I had a lot to say when the scene started. I talked. I cried. We hugged. When it was done, Paul said, "Jenna, that was incredible. This next time, maybe you can do it a little faster."
Steve wasn't one to give unsolicited advice, but he was more than happy to offer guidance if asked. He was a person I could confide in both personally and professionally. For example, I was super nervous about my first guest appearance on The Late Show with David Letterman. Steve was our only cast member at that time who had been on Dave's show, so I asked him what to do. He told me not to go for the joke, but to sincerely share a story and keep it honest and real. He was right. I told a story about my friend in Indonesia whose family rescued a one-armed gibbon ape. For some reason, the gibbon decided that I was its sworn enemy, and it used to pee at the window in their breakfast nook whenever it saw me. I had all the beats of my story planned out, but then Dave threw me a curveball. He asked me why the ape only had one arm. This wasn't part of my story. I started to panic and then remembered what Steve had told me. Don't go for the joke. So, I answered earnestly and stated that the gibbon had lost its arm swinging on a power line. This was met with groans from the audience, but it surprised the heck out of Dave and made him double over with laughter. I also asked Steve a ton of questions about becoming a homeowner. I remember troubleshooting with him about my wonky sprinkler system, in particular the sprinkler heads by my driveway that shot water at you rather than towards the grass. It was a month-long saga, and Steve would check in with me about it every week. To this day, he will know what I mean if I tell him that Station 4 is finally working properly.
So much of our show's success is because of Steve's consistent hard work and emotional balance. There was no drama on our set, and that is 100% due to Steve setting a tone of humility and gratitude with his own behavior from the beginning. We all wanted his respect. Now, if Steve was the man who kept us calm, John Krasinski was the one to pump us up. Every set needs a person who can give you a second wind, and after 6 hours of shooting the same scene in the conference room, we definitely needed that. Whenever we hit a wall, we could count on John to do an impression or crack a joke that would reignite our energy. One time, when our boom operator Nick Carbone accidentally dipped his microphone into the shot, John came up with the catchphrase, "You've been carboned!" This cracked us up. Nick especially. That started a trend where anytime we had to stop a shot for whatever reason, we would say we'd been carboned, and Nick would take a bow. On other sets, when there are issues that stop filming, I watch as the actors and director get all flustered and irritated. But on our set, we couldn't wait to yell, "Carboned!"
John and I had a few inside jokes that I'm sure drove everyone nuts. Like the time we were reminiscing about the kid sister doll that was popular when we were children. John insisted I was the same size as the doll and looked just like her. I actually had a life-size doll growing up. If there was a lull in shooting, John would call out across the set, "Kid sister!" And I would yell back, "Big brother!" We learned later that kid sister's brother was actually called my buddy, but our silly bit was already cemented. It made no sense to anyone else, but it always made us laugh. John even drew us doing our shtick on a piece of scratch paper. Years after The Office wrapped, I was in the toy store and saw a tall doll about my size. I texted a picture of it to him with no caption. I knew he'd know exactly what it meant. He immediately texted me, "Kid sister!"
John has a great laugh. Something happens to John's body when he breaks. He goes all noodly. He wheezes, cry laughs, and finally his body collapses. I was often standing next to him when this would happen. We'd be doing a scene, trying to hold it together, and suddenly John was literally on the floor. If you'd like an example of this, watch any of the Office bloopers, but especially the ones from Dinner Party, when Michael is showing us his new flat-screen television. When you're making a comedy, it's encouraging to have a person who finds what you're doing so funny that they dissolve into a heap on the ground.
I met John's family at the Leatherhead movie premiere. They are the nicest, tallest group of people you'll ever meet. I instantly understood where John got his good manners, Even with all his success, John is still a sweetheart. A few years ago, my husband and I ran into him at a fancy showbiz shindig. My husband hadn't attended many of these types of events with me because we met after the office, and he was feeling a bit out of place. I told him we'd find a corner and people watch, but before we could do that, I heard my name being yelled over the crowd. We turned around and saw John approaching us. He gave me a big hug and I introduced him to Josh. John literally gave him an even bigger bear hug. Then, like a good big brother would, he told Josh that I was the real deal and deserved the best, and he was so happy we had found each other. It was really moving to me and a great icebreaker for my husband at this fancy party. John is the type of person where no matter how much time has passed, you pick up right where you left off.
People often ask, who is most like their character? The answer is easy. Creed. Creed is a lovable, quirky soul both on and off screen. One of the many things I love about Creed is how he will text Angela and me videos and pictures of cats and babies doing silly things. Or he will hit us with a crazy story. They come out of the blue, with no reason or explanation. Ding! Cat taking a bath. Ding! Baby playing in a puddle. Ding! I just got mauled by a hairless cat that wandered into my yard. I love our text thread, and it always brings a smile to my face. Creed is one of those people that lights up any room or text thread with his positivity and love of other people.
Like Jenna said, Creed is quite the character, and we never knew which of his stories were true or which he was making up. Turns out, the hairless cat story was true. Luckily, I've spent enough time with him now that I can tell the difference. He gets a twinkle in his eye when he's spinning a tale, but early on, he'd always fool us. For example, while filming Dwight's speech, season 2, his character gives a shout-out in Mandarin to his friends. We all wondered if Creed could actually speak Mandarin, because in between scenes, he told us he once starred in a hit television series in China. He said he played a captain, and the show was so popular, people would point at him and yell, "Captain Clark!" We hung on his every word. He went on to say, "Yeah, I was actually partially raised in China when I was very little, and now I wake up some morning speaking Mandarin, but then it goes away." We were riveted. Then he cackled and that twinkle in his eye appeared. So which part of the story was true? As it turns out, he did star in a TV show that aired in China called The War of Jean, but it was filmed in Los Angeles. He never lived in China and cannot speak Mandarin. See what I mean? But that ability to tell crazy stories so convincingly made for an amazing character, and we loved hearing his tall tales.
Before landing on The Office, Creed had a very long, exciting career as a musician. He played lead guitar and sang lead vocals with the rock band The 13th Floor, who later became the Grassroots, from 1967 to 1969. He then had a successful solo career and is still writing music and touring to this day. Knowing about his backstory, I was curious to find out how exactly he landed on our show. He told me that he had been working as a background performer and improviser in sketches for the Bernie Mac show, which Ken Kwapis had directed. When Ken found out that Creed had been in the Grassroots, he got a little starstruck. Ken is a massive music fan. He sent an assistant to a local record store to buy a vinyl for Creed to sign. The two of them got to talking about music, and Ken gave Creed his phone number and told him to keep in touch. Later, when Creed heard that Ken was directing the pilot of The Office, he knew what he had to do. He told me, quote, "Now, I had never, ever called anybody like that before, but I called him, as my intuition said, this feels right. This feels right." Creed explained that he was a big fan of the British series and really hoped for a chance to be part of the American remake. Ken talked to Greg Daniels and told him that Creed was a very interesting and funny guy and a terrific improviser. Greg's approach was, "Well, we'll see what we can do. We can put him in the background and see if we can work him into the mix." "That's all I needed to hear," Creed told me. It was the break he needed, and he certainly made the most of the opportunity.
Over the years, Creed has become a close friend. Any of you listening to this who follow me on Instagram know that Creed lives at the end of my street. Yes, Credo, as I call him, is my neighbor. It's one of the joys of my life. I love that we see each other out walking or running errands. Once I heard, "Hey, Pumpkin," as I walked into our local coffee shop. I turned around, and it was Creed. There have been many lovely summer evenings when we have gone on long strolls together in our neighborhood. We've also maybe had some adult beverages and red Solo cups in hand, but that is neither here nor there. I told Creed my dad used to call this hitting the sauce trail. Creed loved that, and so occasionally I'll text him, "Should I walk over so we can hit the sauce trail?" Creed also loves watching documentaries about animals. We once spent an entire evening watching baby iguanas trying to make it to the ocean in the Galapagos. Spoiler alert, there are a lot of snakes trying to eat them, and we kept yelling at the television, "Run, little lizard, run!" to Creed's utter enjoyment. But my favorite evenings are when Creed brings over his guitar. We'll sit out in my backyard or by the fireplace, and he'll play songs for my whole family. It always warms my heart. You never know what to expect when you are with Creed, except laughter.
The other person who blurs the line between real life and his character would be Rainn Wilson. Like Dwight, Rainn is an oddball. He's not a beet farmer, but he does live on a ranch-like home with a zonkey. Yep, a cross between a zebra and a donkey that wanders in and out of his house. Some of my favorite storylines ever on the show were when Pam and Dwight became unlikely allies, as in The Injury, Season 2, when Dwight's concussion turns him into Pam's best friend for the day. Or Vandalism, Season 9, when they team up to investigate who spray-painted obscenities on Pam's mural in the warehouse. This being said, doing scenes with Rainn was never easy. As part of his character, he does a lot of mouth breathing and juts out his chest like a peacock. The moment of transformation from Rainn to Dwight when a director yelled action would always make me laugh. The fun part about acting with Rainn is that, unlike Steve, who almost never broke, Rainn broke all the time. Most of my memories of working with Rainn involve us laughing uncontrollably while the crew waited patiently for us to pull it together.
Folks, I know exactly what Jenna is talking about. Rainn and I were often put in ridiculous situations together. Neither of us are that good at keeping our composure, so D'Angelo moments usually ended with us bursting into laughter. Even when Dwight and Angela were splitting up and we both had to be full of regret and sadness, we couldn't stop laughing. One wonderful example is the dinner date scene in Season 4's Dunder Mifflin Infinity. Here it is.
"Are you enjoying your vegetarian noodles?"
"Very much. How's your meat?"
"Dry. Delicious."
"I heard a joke today."
"Oh, that's funny."
"Yes, it was." "Aw, thanks, Rainn, for recreating that with me." Something about Dwight loving dry meat and Angela not knowing how to retell a joke got us every time.
Rainn can be gruff, surly, grouchy. But underneath all of that is a deeply spiritual man devoted to being of service. In my darkest times, I can turn to him for love and support. He is a safe place to go when I am confused or searching for answers. He is a great listener. Rather than give you advice, he tries to help you find your truth. It's no surprise that since leaving the office, he has devoted much of his time to running Lide Haiti, the foundation he created with his wife, Holiday Reinhorn. Together, they travel back and forth to Haiti, supporting a group that educates and empowers at-risk and marginalized youth, with a special focus on adolescent girls. He also created Soul Pancake, a media company dedicated to exploring, quote, life's big questions with integrity, heart, and humor. I would say that mission statement captures Rainn Wilson exactly. He is a man exploring life's big questions with integrity, heart, and humor. I could not love him more.
Speaking of lovable grumps, do they come any more lovable than Stanley Hudson? Leslie David Baker played grouchy sales representative Stanley and was Angela Martin's competition for best eye roll. I love the way he could take down Michael with a single look. And oh my God, Leslie should have won an award for the way he destroyed Ryan in the Take Your Daughter to Work Day episode. One of my favorite gems he shouted at Ryan was, "Boy, have you lost your mind? Because I'll help you find it." Whenever they wanted Stanley to go off on Ryan, the writers and directors would let Leslie improvise, and it was always brilliant. Leslie is nothing like Stanley in real life. He is a joy to be around and a true gentleman. On long shoot days, Leslie would make sure we ladies had chairs to sit in or water to drink. I remember filming outside on a cold night, and he saw me shivering. In between takes, he took off his suit jacket and wrapped it around me. Leslie was always such a fun, supportive friend for us gals. We could show him countless photos of dresses for events, and he would tell us which one would work and which one should be a hard pass. He was always right.
Leslie and I both love old movies and the glamour of the Hollywood of long ago. I think that's why he was so good at giving advice about award show attire. I love talking through my outfits with Leslie, especially when we got to borrow jewelry. Wearing award show bling made us feel like we were back in the days of that old Hollywood glam. I'll never forget the year I was able to borrow a pink diamond ring worth $1 million. I had to sign so many insurance forms. There was even a guard sent to walk the red carpet with me. I only had the ring for one night, but it was so beautiful I slept in it. I felt like Cinderella the next morning when the jewelry representative came to my house at 9 a.m. and took the ring away. That same year, Leslie wore a stunning borrowed diamond tie clip. We were both positively giddy about our treasures. We discussed how amazingly lucky we were the whole week prior on set, and Leslie was the first person I found when I got to the event. We compared our diamonds and giggled like little kids in costumes.
Now it's time for me to talk about the two guys I spent the most concentrated hours with on the set of Dunder Mifflin. They are the fabulous Oscar Nunez and Brian Baumgartner. According to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, a clump is a group of things clustered together. In offices all over the world, workers are placed into clumps, specifically desk clumps. As everyone who has ever worked in an office knows, your desk clump becomes your de facto work family. It was no different for Brian, Oscar, and me, aka the accounting department. Our desk clump had the only glass partition in the whole bullpen. In my mind, I imagine that Angela Martin requested that because Kevin was smelly, and she needed a barrier from the fumes. We used to joke that Angela and Oscar were bickering parents, and that Kevin was their idiot son. Much of the improvisation that we came up with for all 9 seasons of The Office was based on that single idea. In real life, Brian is more like a childhood pal. You know that friend from the 3rd grade who you are still close with? That's Brian for me. We are both from the South and could relate to being transplants in Los Angeles. We teased each other and roughhoused all the time. He would poke me in the ribs and I'd flop down on his lap and elbow him. We would get the giggles during scenes and each blame the other. Once in a scene, he had to walk past me to fake file some papers, and he bumped into me purely by accident and I went flying. We both lost it laughing, so it became a bit we would do for years.
Brian's character was designed to be the least qualified, least competent of the accountants. The ironic thing is that in real life, Brian is a financial wizard. He does all his own accounting. This might not seem all that impressive, but living as an actor is similar to running a small business. You get income from multiple places, and you don't keep all the money you earn. You must pay managers, agents, publicists, lawyers, union dues, insurance. The list goes on and on. At a certain point, most actors turn this bookkeeping over to a business manager to make sure everyone gets paid, including the IRS, and that your savings and any investments are handled correctly. Not Brian. He does it all himself. When I have a question about how union fees and residuals are calculated, I call Brian. A bunch of us do. In fact, we have a yearly text thread that is basically cast members asking Brian about new union rules and tax laws. We love you, Brian. Thank you.
Oscar was truly my work husband. On set, we were like an old married couple. Every day around 2 p.m., we would share a Coca-Cola. We just needed a little afternoon pick-me-up, and neither of us could finish a whole one. It happened so organically, I don't think either of us ever even spoke about it. One day he had a Coke. I said, oh, I could use some soda. He poured me a little from his can, and that was that. Each day, one of us would grab a Coke and two cups and go find the other. We also took walks together in the studio parking lot. Our schedules were similar, and we would often be on breaks at the same time. And so we would take a brisk walk from the Dunder Mifflin set to the warehouse set, around the writer's building, and down the back alley by the trailers. It made a nice loop. When I became a mom, Oscar became a set uncle to my daughter Isabel. He would visit my trailer whenever she was there and read her books or be silly and make her laugh. She loved him. Isabel wasn't my only family member who loved Oscar. My grandmother, Lena Mae Kinsey, who didn't care for the show because she thought Michael Scott was vulgar, loved Oscar. She visited the set with my mom and sisters when they were in town for my baby shower, and Oscar sat and talked to my grandmother through our entire lunch break. She was completely charmed by him. Months later, I went home to visit her in Texas, and sitting on the little side table next to her recliner was a photo of Oscar mixed in with the photos of her children and great-grandchildren. His photo sat on her side table for the rest of her life.
Oscar was definitely the mayor of the office. If we had a visitor, he was the first to greet them and would probably walk them to their car when they had to leave. We had many guests over the years. People from various charities, and our own friends and family. People were always nervous when they came for a tour. I get it. Stepping onto the set of your favorite TV show and seeing all these characters in real life can be a little overwhelming. Oscar made everyone feel like they were a treasured guest in his own home. He was always looking to find ways to make another person's experience better. For example, he would offer to take a photo before the guest had to ask. It was a gesture I noted and then stole. Like Steve, Oscar had extensive improvisational experience, and he never broke. When you put the two of them together, it was magic. The only proof you need of this is the season 3 premiere episode, Gay Witch Hunt. The kiss between Michael and Oscar in the conference room was not scripted. It was conceived of and masterfully executed on the spot by Steve and Oscar. None of the rest of us knew it was coming. The tension, the dialogue, Oscar's reaction, the surprised look on all our faces, it was all born in that moment. There was one take. We all cheered them at the end. They were so brilliant.
Before we move on, I have to share one of my favorite things about the accounting department, our standing accounting dinners. Although our characters would never have socialized outside of work, in real life, we truly enjoy one another's company. For years, we have had regular accounting dinners, just the three of us going out for surf and turf. Brian finds the best spots and makes the reservations, and Oscar always insists on getting the 5-tier appetizer tray that takes up the whole table. And even though it's harder to get together these days with our careers and our growing families, we still meet up. I love these two guys.
While those guys were the main fellows of our acting troupe, we also had writers BJ Novak and Paul Lieberstein popping in from time to time. Before joining the office, Paul had built an extensive and impressive career as a writer on many shows, including King of the Hill, The Drew Carey Show, and The Bernie Mac Show. He had no experience as an actor. None whatsoever. But for Diversity Day in Season 1, Greg Daniels needed someone to deliver one line as HR representative Toby Flenderson. He asked Paul if he would step in. Paul reluctantly agreed. He was trying to humor Greg's desire for the writers on the show to mix with the actors. I'm pretty sure he thought it would be a one-time thing. The result was so funny that Greg started writing more and more interactions for Michael and Toby, eventually leading to Paul having a regular acting job on the show. His ability to calmly endure Michael's abuse without breaking was legendary. When Greg left his full-time position as showrunner to launch Parks and Recreation with Mike Schur, Paul took over as showrunner along with Jen Salata. I would often see him running back and forth from the writers' offices to hair and makeup, then back to the set or to the editing rooms. He was everywhere. In the early seasons of the show, before Paul was so busy, I'd go over to his office during long breaks in filming. I loved scanning the writers' note cards on his wall in hopes of getting a glimpse into a future storyline. I'd plop down on his couch and start jabbering away, sharing about some funny thing that had just happened on set. Eventually, I'd be called back to work and I'd bounce out the door again. Paul barely got a word in edgewise. I don't know why I chose to do this with Paul and not any of the other writers, but looking back, I think he was the only one who was too polite to kick me out.
BJ Novak was the first person hired on The Office as both an actor and a writer. His character of Ryan Howard has quite the journey from a temporary employee to the vice president of the Northeast region and director of new media to then being convicted of fraud and yet somehow making his way back to Dunder Mifflin. My first impression of BJ was that he was very smart and very honest. Of everyone on set, BJ was the one who would give you the straight truth. He'll tell you you look amazing, but will also let you know you have some food wedged in your teeth. He is also a very classy guy. For example, he wasn't able to attend my 40th birthday party, but as I got ready for the party, a small wooden crate was delivered. Inside was a fancy bottle of champagne and a beautiful card from BJ wishing me a happy birthday. Another time when we were all in New York City to do press and we had no idea where to eat, BJ offered to make reservations and then took Jenna and me out for dinner. The meal was delicious, and we had a fantastic time. My favorite moment of the evening was when we stumbled onto the topic of encounters with celebrities from our childhood. Jenna shared a story that when she was 10, she read a poem she wrote about the St. Louis Cardinals on the local St. Louis radio station. I shared that when I was 8, my parents took me to see Kool and the Gang, and the band singled out our group. BJ casually mentioned when he was 12, he played Scattergories with Michael Jackson at a dinner party he attended with his parents at Deepak Chopra's house. What? We would then learn that BJ's dad is a successful author, and they often went to dinners with eclectic gatherings of artists.
Pam's journey would not have been complete without Roy, and my time on The Office would not have been complete without David Denman. David played Pam's fiancé, Roy Anderson, for the first 3 seasons, and I'd like to use this book as my chance to tell the world that David Denman is not like Roy in any way. He's the best, and I adore him. We both come from theater backgrounds and love playing Texas Hold'em, and so became instant friends. On screen, we had to be awkward and sour to each other, but off screen, it was another story altogether. In fact, it always comes as a surprise to people that David was one of my closest friends outside of the show. We played in weekend poker games together all the time, often going head-to-head, calling the other's bluff. We also went on couples dates, and he was my de facto plus one for show-related events in the early days when we weren't actually allowed to bring a guest. While David didn't mind playing the bad guy, I hated how people would react when they saw us out in public together, sometimes even shouting out rude remarks. David didn't take it personally, but it made me mad. I would want to shout back that David was a wonderful human being. He'd just laugh and say it was a sign we were doing a good job.
Roy worked in the warehouse, which was managed by none other than Daryl Philbin, played by Craig Robinson. As the series continued, Daryl became the assistant regional manager, moving into the bullpen upstairs and becoming a much greater presence on the show. As a cast, we were thrilled to see more of his character because Craig was so much fun on set. There was always a chance that he and Kate would burst into an improvised song. I remember in the Halloween episode of season 8, Spooked. We had been doing a conference room scene for most of the day and were all starting to get loopy. In between takes, Craig started to make up a song about the fog machine we were using, and Ellie, Ed, and Kate all joined in. It was nonsensical, but conference room scenes did that to us. Being trapped in that room for long periods just inspired silliness. I have video of that day, and it never fails to make me smile. The song they improvised went something like this. And, note, I can't sing, so bear with me. We got a fog machine, and you know we're looking really mean in our costumes for Halloween. We got candy and the trick-or-treaters for the scene. Okay, they could do a much better job. But it was so fun. It went on for a while and only stopped when our assistant director told us it was time to start shooting again. And if there was a keyboard around, forget it. Craig would put on a full concert.
Literally everything Craig did on set made me laugh, especially the scenes when Daryl confronts Michael. Daryl was the only one in the office that could flat out say no to Michael Scott. I remember the scene in Back from Vacation Season 3 when Michael accidentally emails Daryl a photo of a topless Jan from his vacation. When he realizes what he's done, Michael runs down to the warehouse only to find Daryl eating a full plate of food with his feet up on the desk. Michael begs Daryl to delete the photo, but Daryl just says, "I'm kind of busy here, Michael." It's an amazing moment. The plate of food was not in the script. Craig grabbed a plate from our snack table to give an added button to the scene. It was perfect comedy. I also loved how in later seasons we got to meet Daryl's daughter, and that after a few torturous years with Kelly, he found love with Val and moved to Philadelphia to start a new business with Jim. Those storylines showed off the softer side of Daryl and were perfectly suited to the big-hearted man that is Craig Robinson. But my favorite memories of Craig are of our on-set sing-alongs. They were joyous, just like Angela described.
We can't close out this chapter without talking about a total sweetheart, Mr. Ed Helms. No one else could play the role of Andy Bernard, prep school wasp and a cappella singing salesman with anger management issues, more perfectly than Ed. I think he made me laugh harder than anyone else on set, and that is saying a lot. We had many great scenes together, but for me, the most fun happened between scenes. We brought out the goofiness in each other. We used to make silly sounds to accentuate a story.
Like what?
Like if someone threw a paper clip into a metal trash can, Ed and I would go, for like 30 minutes.
I remember this.
It would drive everyone nuts. Or we'd pretend to be wacky characters with ridiculous accents. We would do these comedy bits for hours. I feel like in a different life, Ed and I would have been writing partners in some zany traveling sketch comedy show. The Andy-Angela romance storyline happened to coincide with my real-life pregnancy. As a result, I did a lot of scenes with Ed while I was very pregnant, and he always took such good care of me. And for whatever reason, whenever Ed was talking to me, my daughter would start to kick in my belly. During the dinner scene of Dinner Party, we were seated side by side at the table, and it was like Isabel was running a marathon. While we were filming, I subtly grabbed Ed's hand and put it on my belly. Ed's eyes got so big, he looked at me and whispered, "Oh my God!" During breaks, you could often find Ed playing the banjo. Our trailers were side by side, and I used to walk over and listen to him strum away. Near the end of my pregnancy, I would get sleepy and doze off to the sound of his banjo. It will forever be a soothing melody to me because it brings me back to such a happy time. I even changed my alarm clock setting to bluegrass music because I have such fond memories of waking up from my pregnancy cat naps to Ed's playing.
I love the banjo. My husband Lee and I had a bluegrass band at our wedding. I'd always open my trailer window so I could listen to Ed play. I especially loved when Creed would bring his guitar over and they would play together. I think my favorite scene I shot with Ed was from The Convict, Season 3, when Andy sings Rainbow Connection to Pam while playing the banjo. I had to pretend like Pam hated it, but I personally loved being serenaded. When my son Weston was born, Ed sent over a child-sized wooden banjo as a gift. A few years later, he sent a real one. Ed also invited Weston and me to be his special guests at the Bluegrass Situation Music Festival one year at the Greek Theater. We got to hang backstage with Ed and the other musicians. It was so much fun. Despite Ed's best effort, my son chose the drums over the banjo. But I'm just so tickled to have two banjos from Ed Helms. Ed is a caring, thoughtful, and very funny man, and also a proud dad. When Ed's film The Hangover came out and he was catapulted into the realm of big-time movie star, I swear it didn't change him one bit. He is just as considerate and humble as always.
We recently spoke to Ed and told him we'd talk about our love of his banjo playing in the book. And being the doll that he is, he offered to play some banjo for our audiobook listeners.
Hey there, Office BFFs folks, Ed Helms here, and I wrote a little ditty on my banjo called Panorama City, and it is named for the neighborhood in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles where we filmed The Office. Here it is. I hope you enjoy.
Oh, Ed, that was so great.
I could listen to it forever, Ed. Love you.
All these guys filled out the world of Dunder Mifflin so perfectly. And over the years, they have made us laugh and been there for us when we needed a Sauce Trail companion, advice on our taxes, or a tutorial on Madden football. They made coming to work a blast in a million ways. Not too shabby for a sausage fest. Intermission with Ellie Kemper. Do you like my fancy voice?
Oh, you did the voice again.
I did my fancy voice.
I liked it here.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh.
Listen, guys, you're halfway through the audiobook.
Yeah, and we thought this might be a nice time for us to take a little break.
I mean, I could really use a snack. We've been reading for a very long time.
I could always use a snack. There is half a cheese stick calling my name.
I saw it in the fridge, lady.
While we're gone, we thought the wonderful Ellie Kemper could keep you company.
Yeah, we asked her to tell you a little bit about us, and we said she could say anything, that nothing was off limits.
You know, we told the same thing to Rain. You saw how that turned out.
No, we told Rain to be nice.
Well, but we said he could say anything.
Well, anyway, here is the lovely Ellie Kemper.
Hi, this is Ellie Kemper, and here's what I remember about Jenna and Angela on set. I joined the cast of The Office at the end of season 5, and as a newcomer and an enormous fan of the show, I was very nervous to join this group of iconic individuals. And obviously, Jenna and Angela don't exactly play the best of friends on the show, and so it was such a relief in real life to see that they had such a sincere, grounded, real friendship. I remember that they laughed a lot together, that they had a lot of fun together. They had a sort of shorthand way of talking to each other. They ate lunch a lot together. And as someone who had admired the cast of The Office for so long from afar, I felt so relieved to see such a sweet, sincere friendship off the screen. It felt very reassuring to me. So thank you, Jenna and Angela, for being such good friends.
Aw, Ellie Kemper.
She's just the best.
The best. And now, back to the book.
Chapter 8. Award Shows and Hollywood Parties.
By season 3, our show had hit a groove. We were no longer worried about the prospect of being canceled at any time. Our ratings increased, critics had come around, and we began to be nominated for awards. As the popularity of the show grew, so did our social calendar. We started getting invited to all sorts of things: movie premieres, charity events, random parties thrown by magazines, and even fancy award shows. They don't teach you how to pick a gown and pose on a red carpet in acting school. There is no training for how to suddenly be around really famous people without totally losing your cool, or how to adjust to being famous yourself. We had to learn these skills as we went along, and it was not without hiccups. But luckily, we had each other. We failed and succeeded together. Let's start at the beginning, before we hit the groove, back when we were still learning.
Paws and prunes. When I daydreamed about becoming an actress, I couldn't help but imagine myself in a gorgeous gown on the red carpet. The red carpet has been synonymous with royalty for centuries and became a permanent fixture in Hollywood at the Academy Awards in 1961. Did you know that the Oscars red carpet is 50,000 feet long, weighs over 630 pounds, and takes weeks to set up? I could not wait to walk my first red carpet. I wondered about which designer I would wear, who would do my makeup and hair, whether I would don any fabulous borrowed jewels. So, imagine my excitement when Jenna invited me to my first red carpet event. We had just started shooting season 2. Her agent sent her the invitation, and Jenna asked if I'd be her plus one. Jenna told me that the event was to be held at the Lowe's Hotel in Beverly Hills. Beverly friggin' Hills! We were at lunch when she opened the envelope. I was sure I was going to find something printed on gilded paper and tied with a ribbon. But as Jenna handed me the invitation, the first image I saw was a dog.
I probably should have told Angela the invitation was for an animal charity event. She looked a little confused as she read it. The event was called Paws for Style, and the money raised would go to the Humane Society. I was invited to bring my dog Wesley. That was the paws part. The style was a runway show where celebrities walked a catwalk with their dogs, but the dogs were the ones in high fashion. There you have it. Paws for Style. Just to be clear, Wesley and I were not part of the fashion show. Instead, we were invited to watch the fashion show and mingle afterward at a cocktail party. The invitation read, "Upscale Casual, Red Carpet Upon Arrival."
So, it was official. Paws for Style was to be my red carpet debut. And even though I wouldn't be wearing an evening gown, I was very excited. It was time to go shopping. To prepare for the event, I bought a turquoise tank top at Target and another turquoise tank top from The Gap, and I layered them. I layered two turquoise tank tops. Why did I layer two turquoise tank tops? I cannot answer this question because I do not know. I thought I looked cute. Then I added a pair of white jeans and a little turquoise corduroy purse, both also from Target. For shoes, my mom gave me a pair of her very tall wedge heels. They were a size too big and I could barely walk in them, but I was determined. I did my own hair and makeup. I was red carpet ready.
I spent very little time on my outfit. I was most concerned with how I was going to bring my 30-pound terrier mix rescue pup Wesley to a red carpet event. Now, Wesley was a good dog. He had lots of energy, but he was sweet and obedient. Even still, it is not easy to navigate a party with even the most well-behaved dog on a leash, especially when the entire party is filled with dogs on leashes. But I didn't think that far ahead when I RSVP'd. I just thought it would be an interesting night out, so off we went.
The event took place on July 19, 2005, and the headliner was Paula Abdul. Not only was her music a fixture in my teen years, but American Idol Season 4, which she hosted, had just finished filming, and Carrie Underwood had won. I had lots of questions for Paula. Jenna drove that night, and our first hiccup was finding parking. No one told us where to park. This is when we learned that most celebrities hire limos or car companies to drop them off at the door of these events. We did not. We had Jenna's Volkswagen Jetta, and we needed to park close because I could barely walk in my 3-inch wedges, and Jenna had her dog.
As it turns out, the hotel was actually in the heart of Hollywood, not Beverly Hills. I remember circling the block looking for a spot on the street because it cost a fortune to park at the hotel. I'd only just paid off my credit cards, and I could hear my dad's voice in my ear telling me there was no way I should pay $35 to use the valet service at a fancy hotel. We finally found a spot, and Wesley promptly peed on the tree by my car. I was happy about that, because now it was less likely he would pee on the red carpet. As we walked up to the event, I watched Angela's face fall. There were photographers taking photos, but the red carpet was actually a faux wood walkway. I'm guessing this was because of the dogs. It was easier to clean up accidents on this surface than an actual carpet. Then we saw Paula Abdul. She was getting set to walk the wooden carpet with her 3 Chihuahua mixes all dressed in cute sweater outfits. Paula was very friendly. She greeted us with a big smile, and our dogs sniffed each other's butts. My teenage self, who had memorized all the dance moves in her video straight up, was fangirling big time. I really wanted a photo with her, but I was too shy to ask.
So there was no red carpet. I shook it off because Paula Abdul was standing right in front of me. We watched as Paula and her dogs posed for photos. She was clearly a pro. She would turn from side to side and pop her leg out and put her hand on her hip. She was amazing, effortless, even with 3 dogs. I was taking mental notes. And then it was our turn.
I went first. I started by walking Wesley down the carpet on his leash, but a photographer yelled, "Hold up your pup!" Wesley was one of those dogs that was small enough to carry, but too big to hold gracefully. I had to give Angela my purse and pick him up with 2 arms. It was beyond awkward.
I thought Jenna did great. I mean, she was holding a dog. Then it was my turn. It was time for my first red carpet that was actually a wooden floor. I took a deep breath and stepped in front of the photographers. I intended to do my best Paula, turn, leg pop, hip, smile, repeat. But I was afraid to blink or move. I stood there, stiff as a board, holding two purses and staring blankly for an uncomfortably long time. They actually had to usher me off because I was holding up the line. I learned the reason they call a red carpet a step and repeat is that you are supposed to keep moving. I was doing more of a step and stare.
But look at us! We did it! Our first BFF red carpet was in the books. The dog fashion show was adorable. We had a great time mingling with the other guests and their pups, although we could only stay for 2 hours because that was the limit on the meter for my car.
As Jenna said, we had done it, but we also agreed we could do better. But how do you get better at something like this? Practice. I started practicing poses and realized I had no idea what to do with my hands. I looked through dozens of magazines featuring celebrities at events and made note of different hand placements. The one hand on hip, both hands on hips, both hands by your sides, one hand on the thigh, and both hands clasped in front were all options. After trying them out in front of my mirror, I decided both hands clasped in front was the way to go.
My research provided us with this nugget. I read that the reason Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen always look so cute in red carpet photos is because they say the word prune while the photographers are taking the shot. Who knows if this is really true, but that's what I read. The idea is that it gives you the perfect mix of pouty and sexy. We decided at our next press event we were going to say prune while our picture was being taken and clasp our hands in front of our bodies.
We were sure this was the magic we needed to look amazing, and we had the perfect event to try our theory. Jenna and I were invited to Us Weekly's Young Hollywood Hot 20 Party on September 16, 2005. We went to the mall and bought party dresses. The hair and makeup folks from the office got us ready. They even put a shimmery lotion on our arms and legs. We looked so good. We still drove to the party in Jenna's Jetta, but we figured out where to park before we left. We were going to nail this one, guys. When we got to the party, the red carpet was abuzz with activity. Jenna went first, and I could see her saying, prune. But she wasn't clasping her hands. I wasn't sure why. Soon it was my turn. I remembered to move and blink. Things were going great. But when I went to clasp my hands, I realized I was holding my purse. I didn't factor my purse into the clasp pose. Dang it! I began to panic and awkwardly put my hand on my hip. In my head, I was saying, too low, you're putting your hand too low. But it was too late. I was so worried about my arms, I forgot to say prune.
The next day, we were so excited to see our photos. I did the whole red carpet saying prune, prune, prune. And in every photo, I look either constipated or pissed off. I did not master the prune. Angela hated her arm placement, but at least she was smiling. The night wasn't a total disaster. I thought we still looked cute. But we didn't look like Paula, Mary-Kate, or Ashley. We'd get there eventually. Side note, a real fun evening with your friends? Just get together and take photos of one another saying prune,
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 prune. You won't be disappointed.
Award shows and famous people. Our first invitation to an award show was for the 2006 Golden Globes. It was January, and we were halfway through shooting the second season of The Office when Steve Carell was nominated for Best Actor in a Television Series. Our ratings were low, and we were on the verge of cancellation, so this nomination was incredible for the whole cast. It created a great deal of publicity for the show, which meant possibly more viewers and perhaps the chance to stay on the air. But as Steve was the only one nominated, he was the only person invited to attend the actual award show. The rest of the cast was invited to watch the show live at the NBC Universal viewing party nearby. We were not allowed a plus one, but we were thrilled to attend what I called the award show adjacent event. In the weeks leading up to the award show adjacent event, my agent asked a stylist if they could arrange for me to borrow a dress. I didn't get any choices. I received one black dress at my house. It fit. I wore it. My friend knew a jeweler who worked out of her home about 45 minutes away from me in Calabasas. I went over one afternoon, and she let me try on different necklaces and earrings. I ended up borrowing a pearl choker. The Golden Globes were on a Monday evening, and after working all day shooting the show, the hair and makeup team from the office offered to quickly transform the cast for the party. I remember my hairdresser Kim Ferry suggesting an updo as the best way to quickly restyle my hair from Pam to Glam. I arranged for a limo to pick up Angela, Kate, Paul, and me at the set. No more circling the block for parking, and drive us to the viewing party.
I splurged and got my first ever spray tan and bought my dress at Macy's. Since we went straight from work to the party, I just kept my Angela Martin ponytail from the episode we were filming that week. When we arrived, we quickly realized that the NBC Universal viewing party was on the roof of the parking garage for the hotel where the actual Golden Globes were taking place. I called it the parking lot party. NBC put up a huge tent and laid down a large carpet, but on the edges of this outdoor room, you could still see the white lines for parking spots. Around the perimeter of the tent were pleather benches and TVs mounted in fake silver frames. The first thing I noticed, there were no bathrooms. I am the person who always scopes out the bathroom right away. I pee a lot. I would spend the next 2 hours looking for a bathroom. The party was filled with network executives and agents. I'm pretty sure we were the only actors in attendance. And since the office had been on less than a year, people didn't know the show or us that well. There was a tiny red carpet just before you stepped into the party. No one shouted our names for a photo. I had brought my own camera and asked Paul to take a picture of Jenna and me. I thought that this parking lot party might be our first and last experience with a Hollywood award show.
We parked ourselves, haha, on a set of benches and began to watch the live feed of the ceremony. We were all so excited and couldn't stop taking pictures. I have a whole roll of film just of the mounted televisions. NBC served sushi and booze. This was not a great combination. We all got plastered. When Steve's category was announced, we all expected Jason Lee's name to be called. He was the clear frontrunner for his role as the lead in the very popular show My Name is Earl. When Steve's name was called, every single one of us just lost it. It was utter mayhem. Have you ever seen the chaos that ensues when the underdog team wins the World Series? Imagine that, screaming and hooting and high-fiving. The rest of the attendees in that parking lot ballroom looked at us like we were the drunk idiot cousins crashing the black tie wedding, which I guess we were, and we didn't care one bit.
After the show ended and Steve arrived at the party, we all screamed and tackled him. We literally piled on top of him in a massive group hug. He had the biggest smile on his face, a look of total surprise and joy. For probably 10 minutes, we were in a big human clump, smiling, hugging, and passing around his statue. When it was my turn to hold the award, I thrust it in the air triumphantly and hit Phyllis in the face. Phyllis said she didn't even feel it. That's how crazy happy we all were. After much celebration, I finally found out where the bathrooms were. You had to cross a bridge from the parking garage to the hotel to get to them. It was a hike. So I asked Jenna to go with me. What we didn't know was that this corridor was also being used by the guests of the actual Golden Globes to leave the show. So there we are, swimming upstream against movie stars like Russell Crowe, Keira Knightley, Judi Dench, Terrence Howard, and more. We dove into the bathroom, erupting into laughter, and bumped right into Rona Mitra. I was a fan of hers from her show The Practice, so of course I asked for photos. In the bathroom. Yep, I was that person. The whole evening was full of hilarious and ridiculously awesome moments. It was one of the most amazing nights of my life.
Without a doubt, it was one of the most joyous nights of my life as well. We closed down that party, dancing, drinking, and posing with Steve's award. Steve kept saying over and over that he couldn't have done it without us. He was so gracious. Steve remained the same wonderful Steve after his win. But the energy surrounding the show started to change. We were on people's radar now.
The show really skyrocketed in popularity after we won an Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series in September 2006. Once again, we were not the favorite to win, but we did. Our struggling show had now won 2 major awards in 1 year. Journalists started coming to set wanting to do stories on us. Access Hollywood showed up for interviews, and people learned our names. The change was real and fast.
I'll never forget the time we were eating outside on the patio of a restaurant in North Hollywood when someone screamed from the passenger side window of a passing car, "Jenna and Angela, we love The Office!" Or the time we were shopping in the seasonal aisle at Target and heard someone humming The Office theme song over our shoulders. After nearly 2 years of working on the show in relative obscurity, we were suddenly popular.
During the run of The Office, the cast and crew received a combined total of 163 award nominations and 30 wins. As a cast, we took home 2 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 1 Primetime Emmy Award, and a TV Land Award. And now, after attending so many of these events, we learned a few tips and tricks we'd like to share with you. I don't want to say that Jenna and I have the whole fancy Hollywood award show routine down, but by the end of our 9 years on the show, we could blend into the red carpet crowd without looking like total idiots. And we always had a really good time. So, should you find yourself at one of these gala shindigs in the future, here is
the official Office BFF guide to Hollywood parties.
Number 1. Eat. One thing all award shows have in common is that they are very, very long. Eat before you go. We cannot stress this enough. There is usually very little food, but ample amounts of adult beverages. This can be a problem.
At the Emmys, you sit in a traditional theater, as if you were attending a play. Once inside, they do not serve any food or drinks at all. At the Screen Actors Guild Awards, they do serve a meal, but I swear it's never enough. It's like a meal for a toddler. It is tiny. Eat before you go. I don't care how tight your dress is.
I do not like to be without food. Ever. But certainly not at award shows. The red carpet portion of these events starts in the mid-afternoon. You are on the red carpet by 3 p.m. The event starts at 5 p.m. There is no dinner. The after parties usually have food, but you won't get to those until at least 9 p.m. I usually try to pack a snack. Yes, I'm that lady. I am not embarrassed to pull a protein bar out of my purse while chatting with Tom Hanks. I'm just not. The only problem is that those fancy evening bags are usually the size of your hand. I've gone to events where I've had to choose between bringing my phone or a granola bar. This creates a major dilemma for me. I need my phone. I also know what happens when I get hangry.
For Jenna to say, "I don't like to be without food," does not properly communicate what this woman is willing to do when she is hungry. You know, in the dinner party episode when Pam says, "I just want to eat," that was 100% based on Jenna in real life. Let me provide you with an example. It was the 2010 Emmys, and The Office was nominated for Best Comedy Series. We were all starving because, despite the advice we just shared with you, none of us followed it. During a commercial break, Jenna turned to me with fire in her eyes and said, "Let's go look for food." This was not a suggestion. She was giving marching orders. We gathered our dates, Jenna's husband Lee and my friend Michael, and off we went. First, we checked the bars in the lobby. No food. Then we went to the back of the ballroom near the bathrooms. No food. But I did see Anne Margaret and Alexander Skarsgård. That was pretty cool. But Jenna had no time for chatter about celebrity sightings. She was on a mission. Jenna found a young gal wearing a staff blazer and a headset, holding a clipboard. Bingo. Headset gal quietly said something into her headset mic and then motioned for us all to come quickly. Headset gal was surprisingly agile and fast. We were practically running down a long hallway to keep up with her. She led us around a corner to a security guard standing by a big, thick curtain. Headset gal whispered something to him, and he quietly ushered us behind the curtain. There we were greeted by an elegant older woman in an evening gown who was also wearing a headset and holding an even fancier-looking clipboard. The room was dimly lit, and my eyes took a moment to focus, but it was clear that she was important. She sternly whispered for us to be very quiet. I nodded. I did not want to piss off this woman. Elegant headset woman pointed us toward a table of food. Jenna pounced, piling cheese and salami on a plate. I looked around for Michael and Lee, but they were nowhere in sight. I went to the back to the big curtain and found them standing with the security guard. Michael and Lee apparently weren't allowed anywhere near that food. I motioned to Jenna and pointed to Lee and Michael, but she just kept eating. I was finally able to convince the security guard to let our dates in, and we went to find Jenna. She had moved on from the charcuterie table to the dessert table. She handed the three of us giant chocolate chip cookies and never broke stride, chewing the entire time. It was then that I realized that not only were we in a private green room for Emmy presenters and nominees, but this room was actually just a curtained-off section situated right on the stage. Let me repeat, we were on the actual Emmy stage. That is why it was so dimly lit. The show was literally going on just a few feet away, and we were stuffing our faces with chocolate chip cookies. No wonder they kept telling us to be quiet. There were only a handful of other people in the green room. Lawrence Fishburne was about to present an award. As I took the last bite of my cookie and started in on a plate of cheese, I felt a gaze come over me. I briefly made eye contact with Mr. Fishburne. He leaned over to a man seated next to him and whispered something along the lines of, "Who the fuck are these assholes?" I whispered to Michael, "Did Lawrence Fishburne just call us assholes?" He fervently nodded yes. I took that as a sign that we should wrap it up.
I missed this exchange entirely. I was too busy going back for seconds of salami. Lee whispered that we needed to go, and he seemed to mean it, so I grabbed a banana and we tiptoed the heck out of there. When we finally got back into the hallway, we burst out laughing.
Only Jenna would find a way to muscle us onto the actual Emmy stage for snacks. I'm sure Lawrence Fishburne will never hear this, but just in case, we're very sorry. We were those assholes shoving cheese and cookies into our faces while you were preparing to go on the Emmy stage. Also, to the Television Academy, can you please consider adding a snack table by the bathrooms for future ceremonies? Be sure to include the giant chocolate chip cookies. They were very good. Thank you.
This is a true story, and I'm not in the least bit ashamed. In fact, I'm proud of it.
Number 2. Never pee alone. Finding a bathroom is tricky. You will likely have to walk a very far distance and climb a stupid amount of stairs in your ridiculously high, uncomfortable heels to find a bathroom. You might get lost and find yourself in a random hotel corridor with a rollaway bed. You'll need your BFF to document the moment if the lighting is good.
Ladies, listen to us. You need a bathroom buddy. And not just to take photos. If you've ever gotten married, you know what it's like to try peeing while wearing your wedding dress. You need someone to hold up your dress, your purse, probably your shoes, and help you get your Spanx down and then back up again. Here's something else they don't teach you in acting school. If you win an award, you have to carry it around all night. That means you also have to carry it to the bathroom and either set it on the ground or ask your bathroom buddy to hold it while you pee. Visiting the bathroom is a must for other reasons, even if you don't have to go. One of our favorite parts of award shows is the bathroom. You can see tons of A-list movie stars in line for the bathroom. It was while standing in line for the bathroom that I found myself next to Angelina Jolie, the most beautiful woman in the world. We didn't speak to each other, but still. It's also fun to see a SAG award or an Emmy sitting on the sink while someone washes their hands. In summary, go to the bathroom, bring a buddy.
Number 3. How to avoid wardrobe mishaps. If you attend enough of these events, you will eventually have a wardrobe mishap. It's destined to happen. When it happens to you, perhaps it will bring you comfort to know we've been there.
Mine happened early. It was August 11th, 2005. And Steve had invited the entire cast to the premiere of his movie, The 40-Year-Old Virgin. We were very excited to attend the premiere as a cast and support our friend for such a big movie opening. Our wardrobe designer helped me find a dress and some gold vintage shoes to match. I felt very stylish. The dress was unusual. It had a teal silk slip covered in blue-green printed lace and a wide, bright blue ribbon that sat on my hips and hung down to my knees in the front. Imagine a mermaid dressed as a flapper from the 1920s. The premiere was on a Thursday evening, we went after a full day of work. I only had about 20 minutes to get ready before I had to be on my way. In my rush to get ready, I'd forgotten to use the restroom. When I arrived at the event, the first thing I did was run to the bathroom. I was very careful not to pee on the long blue ribbon. I mean, that would have been a disaster. I held it above my head. Mission accomplished. No pee on ribbon. I reapplied some lip gloss, checked myself in the mirror. I looked great. Time to hit the red carpet. I walked, I posed, I felt sassy in my dress. I even did an over-the-shoulder pose. Lucy Davis, who had played Dawn in the British Office series, was there. We posed together. What a night. Once inside, I found my seat between Rain and John. I waved to Angela a few seats away. When I sat down, something didn't feel right. I could feel the fabric of the seat directly on my bottom. I thought, this feels odd. I reached my hand behind me and felt lace and then skin. No slip. Where was the slip? I'll tell you. It was tucked into my underwear. It was in this moment that I realized I had just walked the entire 40-year-old virgin red carpet with my slip tucked into my underwear with only lace and a sash hiding my undies. But wait, there is more. I was not wearing cute undies. I was wearing what Angela calls laundry day undies. They were from a Target variety pack and featured a silly butterfly and flowers print.